This leads us to the second discussion about Gideon. What we're trying to do is we're trying to get down the basics of his life, which leads up to his battles, and there afterwards. The unique part of Gideon is actually going to be after the battle, so we're going to try to push to get to the end of his battles today, depending on if we can make that. And we just ran out of the sources, so you're all here, sorry. So what we're going to do is we're going to move through, and we're in the middle of the sixth parak of Shoftim, which is describing his meeting the angel and being appointed as the leader. Finally, we're up to I think Pasuk Yud Ches. Pasuk Yud Ches, the last thing that Gideon has said is he sees this angel slash messenger who he doesn't really know who he is, and he says to him, you know, please give me a sign. Show me something that shows me that you are either divinely sent or that there's enough schut for the Jews, whichever way we interpreted it last time, why he needed this particular sign. And now he has the follow-up. So in Yud Ches he says, "Al na tamush mizeh, don't move. Stay where you are. Ad bo yelech until return. V'hoytzeis yes minchasi, and I will bring out my peace offering. V'inachti lefonecha, and I'll place it before you. V'yomar, anochi eshev ad shuvcha. You know what? I'm gonna stay here until you return. Until you return to me." Fantastic. What happens? The Gideon ba, and Gideon comes. Vayas gedi izim ve'efas chemach matzos. So he makes this young kid of an offering as his offering, and an efas chemach matzos, which is this unleavened bread this is his mincha, his peace meal offering. Habasar som basal. He placed the meat in the basket. V'amarok som baparur, he placed the soup in the pot. V'yaseh lo v'tachas ha'elo v'yagash.
How did he feel he had to give him an offering?
Oh, excellent question. So, Sadi, why does he need to bring an offering? So, part of this, part of the Mefarshim say is that he needs to do this because if this person is directly representing God, then he will accept this as an offering. If he is just an emissary, some form of messenger, then no messenger accepts an offering himself, right? So he's bringing him almost like he's sacrificing to him, right? So his response is what Gideon's looking for as well. He wants to know: is this person going to accept this just as I bring it, or is he going to say, "Well, this is, meaning"? How directly is he is he related to God who's sending him? That's part of what Gideon's...
And he has accepted. Gideon has accepted the fact that this is a messenger.
That's what's under contention now. That's what he's asked for the sign, and we haven't seen the sign yet. So that's what he's trying to work out. And part of that is he's looking for a sign, but also part of it is he going to just accept it just as? Right, yeah. That's exactly part of Gideon's part of what he's actually thinking right now. So he arrives, he brings this whole meal offering. What's the response? In Pasuk Chaf, Vayomer Elav Malach Elohim, the angel of God says to him, Kach es abasor ves matzos. Take the meat, take the matzos, vanach es hasela el hasela halaz. Place it on this rock in front of us. Ves amarok shofoich vayazken. Pour out the soup. It's interesting, I don't know. We can think about it just on the memo board, why it is that the soup's not part of this.
So why do you normally bring soup for a carbon?
Interesting. We don't see that usually. But I think what Esther's saying is it sounds more human then.
Yeah.
So it sounds more like there's a human part to it than the actual sacrifice part to it. So maybe that's part of the test. I'm not sure. Because you're right, we don't see usually, so it sounds like more of a human kind of, you know, homecoming dinner more than a sacrifice in that respect. So maybe it has that duality, which is why he's pouring it out. So he's saying, I'm not human. Well, maybe he's coming all. Maybe that's part of the test.
Yeah.
Meaning, he's wanting to say, are you going to accept this as a human, or are you going to accept this as a messenger of God? Vayishlach malach Hashem es kitzei hamishenes va'asher b'yado. See, the angel takes the edge of the stick which he has. Vayigah b'basar, and he touches the meat of a matzot and the bread, or the peace offering, vatal ha'esh minatzur, and the fire comes out of the very rock, vatochal sabasar v'samatzot, and it consumes the meat and the bread, umalach Hashem holach me'enov, and he disappears.
Right, so
clearly, right, so clearly this, oh, I don't know if that's the reason, because, you know, if we want to be supernatural, we don't need necessarily to...
Then why did he have to do it?
Yeah, it was Eliyahu, exactly. Eliyahu was a good example where he actually told him to douse the meat in water to show that it's supernatural. It might mean, I think from what the discussion that we'd be having, I think it's fair to say that he wants to see if he's human or angelic or direct messenger of God. So he brings him something which could go either way. It could be like a meal or it could be a sacrifice. By him telling him to spit out the soup, it's clear this is a sacrifice, and the continuation clinches the deal, right? So it burns up and he disappears. And at this point in time, Now we have an epiphany. Vayar Gidon ki malach Hashem hu. Great. Now we got it, right? He sees it as an angel of God. Why does he see it as an angel of God? First of all, the sign. But second of all, he takes it as a sacrifice. It wasn't a meal. Great. On the lines that we were thinking. Vayomer Gidon. And Gidon says, Aha, Hashem Elokim ki al kein ro'isi malach Hashem panim panim. Now, aha is a expression. Now, they translate it over here as alas. But it's clearly some form of real surprise that is expressing over here, because he wasn't sure up to this point, right? Wow. He hasn't, right? So depending on where you're from and how you translate it, but it's some form of amazement. But let's put in another word. Not only amazement, what other word would we put in here?
Shock.
I would put in here as well, shock leading to fear. Right, there's some form of fear over here which the Mefarshim see in the statement. Why should he be scared at this point in time?
Well, he's
scary. So he's had a supernatural experience over here. Up till now, it could have all been natural. And now, retroactively, he's looking back at this experience and saying, I've just seen something which is not bound to physical form, which may mean that I'm dead. Right? So, when people experience supernatural experiences, one of the fears is maybe I'm no longer living. Right, so the Malbim even points that out right over here, very fascinatingly. Once you're in the beyond the physical realm, he's concerned for his life. So there is some form of fear over here. I'd like to parallel it with one other case. Sorry, what are you saying?
Where do they see the fear?
Where does they see what?
Where do they see the fear?
The fear. Meaning, what does aha mean? Is aha a shock, or is it more than that? That's where it enters. So what you're arguing, Ruth? Is that this is not a shock. This is just a wow.
English
translation.
Mm-hmm.
I ask, does this
word appear in another place in Tanakh? And I don't know offhand. What we should do is just if we to do this properly, is that if you're to take a Shimshon's father.
Oh, he thought they were gonna die.
Right. So you're right. So that's another place that aha is. There was one way to do this now and easily besides the word searching is that on the Masorah, the old Tanakhs have a Masorah and tells you all the other places it appears in the Tanakh. So the Masorah Gedolah. So that's something which let's should we do that for homework? We'll on next week we'll discuss it. Can I just borrow your pencil for a second, Tina? Thank you so much. So I'm just gonna see the source in that, following up on Ruth's question over there. What is it that makes aha? Where else do we see that it has this theme? Just another parallel over here, just worthwhile thinking, is this is a parallel. Where else do we see this might lead into it. Where else do we see such a reaction? Retroactive reaction or fear? Right, so Yaakov, when he wakes up, right, I would parallel to that as well. Yaakov arrives in theoretically, Beit El. It's not so clear where exactly it is. But he arrives, he puts 12 stones down, he goes to sleep, he has the revelation of the ladder in Parashas Vayetze. And when he wakes up and he realizes that he just had a supernatural experience, it says that he had a tremendous fear because of what he just experienced. So just on a parallel of that, that might be just something to bear in mind. There are going to be a number of parallels. I'm going to leave some of them open for you as we go to the Avot over here. There's going to be some parallels to some of the incidents which the Avot have underwent. So this is one of them over here. Avram Avinu is going to be a big parallel that we're going to see coming up a few times.
Therefore, we're saying that we could put Gidon almost on the same level.
I don't know.
I said almost.
No,
I don't know. If there is such an incident, I don't know.
And he wasn't.
I question that in terms of how he's going to experience things in a similar manner. There's going to be similar ways he talks, and there's going to be similar experiences he's going to do.
Madre Kolk, where he wasn't where they
right.
were.
Right. So I don't know. Certainly, the fact that he's having this experience puts him on the pedestal of a prophet, right? But to the degree of where he is in terms of Avot, I wouldn't be able to see from this particularly. I don't think. So, in response to this, to this to his expression, this is another indication of his fear, maybe, is Vayomer lo Hashem, and God said to him, Shalom lecha, al tira, don't fear. Right, so clearly is the response is of fear, v'lo tamus, you're not going to die. Sorry, we should have just gone straight into that. When I was preparing this, at least 2 weeks ago. So so he says, you're not going to die. So clearly these are the things which are incorporated in the message of Aha. Vayiven sham Gidon mizbeach laHashem, and Gidon makes an altar to God. Vayikra lo Hashem Shalom. He calls it the altar of God is peace. Ad hayom hazeh, until today. Oydena ba'ofra aviyeh ha'ezri. It's still in the place of Ofra, the father of Ezri, which is because he is the family of Ezri. Now, Ad hayom hazeh is just a discussion in general in Tanakh, which we're not going to go into right now. What does it mean? Meaning to say, when is the Ad hayom hazeh referring to? Is it referring to our times? And the author was saying that is a continuing Ad hayom hazeh? Or is it the author put in, or who's the author of Sefer Shoftim? Shmuel. The Gemara says that Shmuel Hanavi was the one who authored Shoftim, so it could be Shmuel saying, until his time, we know about this, and all the people reading Shmuel say, yeah, of course, we know, right? We know where Wrigley Stadium is, right? So it's like they're relating to that reality that Shmuel's there, okay?
Now, going back to Kaf Gimel, and God said to him, all of a sudden he had this revelation after the angel came to him?
Yeah, just remember that even when the angel was speaking to him earlier, the pasuk sometimes referred to the angel speaking as God speaking. So yes, it sounded like, even though it seemed like an angel, there was God in manifest, but he didn't realize till now. Now God sort of breaks through, and it's clearly God. When he names the altar, do you think when he says Hashem Shalom, why would he name it Hashem Shalom? Basically, because he welcomes God, he's not in danger. God just said he's not in danger. Another thing to bear in mind is it's in peace of his life. He thought he was just under threat, but it also might be threats from the outside and future. Okay, so just let's think. It might be a plea as well as a reflection. It might be a plea as a let's focus all the threats that Gideon's about to encounter, and that might be part of what he's doing as well. Okay, so now we get into the thick of it. It was during that night. Take your father's ox, and the 7-year-old second ox. Destroy the Baal altar to your father, and the tree. This is and the Asherah, which is a Avodah Zarah, tree. Which is on this altar, Tichros, cut down. Now, a lot of very fascinating things over here. First of all, you see the Jews are involved in idol worship. So this is a bit shocking, first of all, because we haven't heard of anything like this up till now. Meaning, all we know is the Jews are being oppressed by the Midianites. We don't know anything about Avodah Zarah. So it's a bit of a shocker. So just to go back into that time for a second. Baal and Asherah, who was Baal? What kind of God was he?
Fertility.
He was fertility and
God of the north.
God of the rain as well.
Yeah, water.
So a God of water. The two are linked in terms of the myth. If you want to get into the myth, it's the two are linked, and the Baal as understood through the Baal epic and all these things. The Baal is the rain god. So why is that important to us? It's important to understand is that the context, and many argue this, is that when it talks about the Jews serving Avodah Zarah, does that mean to say that they have completely rejected Hashem?
No.
Not necessarily. Right.
Right.
Absolutely. Right. So this is important. Is that these are agricultural people, and they're hedging. They say like this: look, there are many powers out there. There are many powers out there. There's God of the Jews, and you know what? There's also the Baal, who's the god of the rain, god of the land, of the people around us. So let's hedge. You know, we'll sacrifice to all of them. Now, in a polytheistic culture, that's fine and dandy. Why? Because polytheism means that there are lots of powers, and you can serve each one, you try to appease each one appropriately. But in monotheism, that's exactly antithetical. So that's the problem that we're going to encounter. That's what it is when Eliyahu later on says, just we mentioned Eliyahu before, when Eliyahu talks to the Jews and he says, Ad Mosai Atem Pois Chim Al Shnei Seifim. When he says to him, you're balancing on two different buildings over here, in a sense, you cannot serve God, Hashem, when there is somebody else in the picture. It doesn't work. It's not the same thing as in the polytheistic culture. So,
when they were promised the land, God said that it's not like Egypt where you just get your water if you peddle this thing. You have to answer to me, and then I'll give you rain.
Right. So this is the perversion of that of this is the fact that they're involved in Baal now is the perversion of that of the way Eretz Yisrael is supposed to operate. But there's an incredible, incredible point in this pasuk which I think we all missed over, and that is something which is really shocking. The second ox is how old?
7 years.
Why 7 years? Why do we need to know that 7 years old? What about the first one? How many years was that? 3 years? Why is 7 years important to us? So Chazal say that there were in Shemitah, it could be part of it, but in terms of Avodah Zorah, why is 7 a relevant number? They would, in those days, they would fatten up these oxen for 7 years before sacrificing them to the deity. Okay, so they had a practice of 7 years of fattening, which means to say, now take this back, take this is the Ralbag's point of view. This means to say that they've been 7 years in the service of Baal. Now this is a scary statistic, because turn back to page one for a second. How long have they been in Midianite oppression? We missed over this in the first pasuk. It's just on the first page. They've been under Midianite oppression for 7 years. Wow. The Ralbag points out, this is something we just miss over when we glance over this pasuk. There's been 7 years of servitude and there have been 7 years of fattening. So it's very clear that from the beginning of the oppression, now I don't know what you're going to call the chicken or the egg. We can argue. But over here it's clear that from the beginning of the oppression, the Jews are already involved in this polytheistic mindset. Incredible, just something to be aware of. It's quite a shocking realization when we're looking at this period of time. Okay? That's all that's going on. This is all just in one pasuk over here. Great.
You said that in order for them to be under Midianite oppression, they obviously weren't doing too well before, otherwise Hashem wouldn't have loved that.
Yes.
So it's not like they went into it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you're right. But it's shocking to the degree, meaning you're right that they were involved in the non-Jews, but here we see from day one, you're pointing out that there had to be a cause for them to get into the oppression in the first place.
They were there, and then the Midianites kind of gave them up.
Right. So they just push them over. I agree with you. So there must have been a reason why they got into the oppression in the first place, which was there must have been something involvement, either involvement with them or actual real idol worship. But here we have it, unfortunately, from at least the very beginning. So moving a little further into the pasuk Chavav, when you destroy the Baal altar, you will build a God altar al rosh ha-mo'ozazeh on the top of this stronghold b'ma'aracha in an ordered place. Ma'aracha is everything arranged. You should take this ox, the second ox, which is the one which was fattened, and you shall bring it up as a, and you'll bring it up as a fully burnt sacrifice, with the very wood of the Avodah Zorah tree. Right? So it's like it's the destruction is yielding the creation, right? So Gideon takes 10 men, me'avodah, from his servants, va'yas kasher diber elav Hashem. He does do what God says. They were scared. There was obviously, this also is something is a window into the culture. They're scared of the people around them that doing this would put them at threat. So therefore they have to do it at night. Okay? So this sort of, this gives you a window into the climate of Avodah Zorah at the time as well, that people will be highly defensive of it. And this also gives you a window into Hashem Shalom as well. Remember, this may be one of the pleas in the altar is whatever he's going to have to do for God, he needs to be begging for peace. Okay, that's one indication. Also, night. Let's keep night in our minds. Okay, a lot of the things that are going to go on with Gideon are going to be at night. Okay, so let's just keep that as a theme in the background, and for all his escapades are going to be at night.
Can you bring sacrifices at night? I thought it was
great. Let me ask you worse, Sally. Can you bring sacrifices on top of an Avodah Zorah altar with Avodah Zorah wood?
Yeah, sure, especially.
Absolutely not. Right. Absolutely not. So, all of this is what's called Horas Shah. Horas Shah means to say that certain times God can tell a prophet to break the rules a little bit, in order for a specific message, there's something very specific that needs to be achieved over here. Right? What's another example, a classic example of Horas Shah? Most classic in Tanakh is
Eliyahu.
Eliyahu was a classic example because at that time the Beis HaMikdash was existing And he tells all the prophets of Baal, also Baal then, to bring sacrifice. And he brings the sacrifice up on an external altar. That you're not allowed to do, right? But he was allowed to do it. Why? Because the particular message which he needed to get across that time, which is exceptionally successful, we all admit, right? Similarly over here. But why do you think God is doing this? What is the message? What is the point of the Saras Shah? What is to be gained by doing this?
I think maybe that he's following the orders.
Awesome, great, exactly. So that's that. The Mefarshim take it minimalistically, as you said. Minimalistically, this Haras Shah is to do what? Is education, on the one hand. This education, and where does education start? It starts with Gideon himself. I mean, he needs to be able to do this. He needs to be able to break the surrounding aura of idol worship, and therefore he needs to do that. I would argue, the Mefarshim don't necessarily say this, but I would argue maybe even external education as well. Depending on, we'll see the follow-up and the reaction to this. But maybe the education is not only internal, but also external. But there has to be a point whenever you see a breaking of the rules, just so candid. So yes, that all fits into that exact theme. So now, he's done this, and what happens? The next morning they all get up, in the morning, their friendly altar, their town altars are destroyed, the trees cut down, and their pride, their seven year old fattened cow is now shechted and on the mizbech. They ask each other who did this. They searched out, they asked, and they told. Clearly, the told is from the people who are with him, probably. Gideon ben Yoash also had davar hazeh. So clearly came out that Gideon, the son of Yoash, is responsible.
It's surprising that he found 10 people.
I was also thinking about that. It's surprising that in such a climate where he's scared of other people, that even 10 people were willing to help. But it's clearly they're on the fence because they're telling right now.
Well, they were from his household.
No, they were servants and they're from his household, but it seems like they do tell under the pressure. We're not sure what kind of pressure. The people of the city come to Yoash, this is Gideon's father. Mm-hmm. Take him out and die. Wow. Now you can understand why you're scared. Kinotatz et mizbach ha-baal, because he broke the Baal's altar. V'chi koras ha-asher asher alav. He destroyed the Asherah tree on top of it. V'yomer Yoash l'chol asher omdu alav. Ha-atem t'rivun la-baal. He turns to everybody else and says, will you contest, will you fight for the Baal? Im atem toshin osoi, asher riv lo yumas ad ha-boker. Anybody who will save him will be put to death before the morning. If God will fight with him, because he broke his altar. Very confusing words. Very confusing words. What is Yoash saying?
If Baal is a real Baal, he would be
great.
Right.
So message number one is and the Malbim brings this out just like you said, Erica. Is that you know what he's saying? He's saying to them is, if he's such a strong entity, then let him fight his own battles, right? After all, he's a god. So parallel to Avram, very interesting over here. This is just interesting, is Gideon's put in the spot of destroying his father's and city's idols, and the response, interestingly, from his father defending him, is the response of, well, the big idol has the hammer, right? In a sense that, well, shouldn't they be able to defend themselves? So there's just interesting if that's what he's saying.
And even though his father had this idol, mm-hmm. Gideon had to have grown up in his household. And he knew the history of the Israelites. And there was something that he learned in his father's household that this seems to point to.
Right, so
his father was
there's something in his father, the fact that his father is able to flick that switch clearly, which was part of his education, which I agree with you. Meaning this is where it comes from, that his father is able to stand up to the people against him. Now you'll notice that there's no longer a conversation after this, right? Sorry, actually, there's Vayikra lo bayomahu Yerubbaal lemor. They call him, meaning Gideon, saying he is called Yerubbaal. He gets a second name. Yarev lo ha-baal, because he will contend, let Baal contend against him, kinotat es mizbechoi, because he destroyed his mizbech. Sort of like, let Baal start up with him now. That's Yarev Baal, Yerubbaal, that's Gideon's going to be second name, it's going to flow through the story as we go. But what is the response? Just coming back to what you're saying is he said he made a very strong claim. It sounds like there's silence afterwards, which shows you how strong his father was, which is maybe the place from where Gideon came out of in terms of his world outlook. But let me ask you, there might be another way of what Yoash was actually saying. Rashi suggests that in Yoash's statement, you know what he's saying? He's saying, just wait until morning. He's pushing them off. You know what? You can get him. You can find Gideon and sort him out, but just wait until morning. And why is he doing this? Meaning to wait until the next morning. It sounds like he's saying pushing off a day. That's what it sounds. It sounds like he's saying, you know what? He says, if you have a problem, you can deal with it, but deal with it, just wait a little bit. Wait a little bit to get Gideon. In order, why would he say that? In order that Gideon should escape. Right? So he's giving him an alibi at the moment. He's giving him some time to escape. And just within that does exist in the words over here. It's just it's harder to understand because we don't see any further negative forces against Gideon from the Jewish side at this point. Right, so it does sound like they're somehow convinced. So I'd be more inclined to follow the Malbim's pirush over here that he was defending his son, and the people sort of took the lead, and then they said they called him Yerubal exactly because of that. Because let Baal start with him. Yes, you're right, Yoash.
Well, we established at the beginning that they did believe in gods, multiple, unfortunately.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's a reasonable argument.
It is a reasonable argument that the bits. To a certain degree, just something we should just be aware of, like when thinking about Egypt in the past parishes as well, is to what degree does the power of one god of another establish the primacy of that god as a monotheistic god? That's something which is so it's something we have to think about a little bit. Is does proving that our god can beat your gods show that we have a more powerful god, or that there is only one god? So, we can debate what level of lesson they've learned right now, but
the bigger lesson.
Right, but at least
the
this lesson.
The smaller lesson yeah. is, or not lesson, or point accepted is fine. We'll let the gods fight it out.
Okay, good. Yeah, so let's leave it at that. At the very least, we don't see any other indications otherwise. But I'm just. But you're right. It does seem like this is in terms of polytheistic cultures could be a very good. This is definitely his stronger. So don't start. That could be the message. And in Egypt, more is achieved. More is achieved in Egypt. Why? Just out of interest, just on the topic. Why is it that Egypt is is a stronger proof? That's not just one god is stronger. Where do you see that?
Render their gods
useless. But also, there's one factor which is something you should keep in mind all the way through. Is
also announce that must be the true god.
Paro at the very end. Paro said he sinned and he's worried, and I don't think he ever specifically announces it. One thing which is a theme throughout Yetzias Mitzrayim is precision. Okay, power doesn't always have precision. So harnessing powers in other gods doesn't always give you exact results. When you're an employee, when you are a recognized servant of Hashem, then you do have precision, and that's why there's a lot of precision throughout the Makos, and it's very important. That's a particular theme, but over here we have over here. This is Gideon's response. I'm really sorry that we're just getting to the end of our time now. But what we stands before.